Good evening. It is just a huge pleasure to be here. And, you know, to see friends and to see fellow practitioners that I've learned with and that I've learned so much from. And so my intention tonight is to leave a lot of time for us to talk as a group. That may be during the talk, it may be at the end, but it's really always so useful when we as a group generate the wisdom. A lot of deep practice in this room. So tonight's topic is the five lay ethical precepts. And just very quickly getting a sense of the group, just by a show of hands, how many people are minimally, basically familiar with the precepts, you know, just what they are? Okay, great. So most people, and if you don't know, don't worry, because I will say what they are in the course of the talk. How many people have intentionally worked with the precepts as a form of practice? Okay, so good, maybe almost half. And how many people, do not feel put on the spot, how many people have a current daily practice with the precepts? Yeah. That's a good starting point. And I'm talking about this topic today because it's one that is really near and dear to my heart and that I've been working with for a number of years. And just to acknowledge, we generally have a little bit of an ethic of trying to avoid naming names on the recording, but just to acknowledge that a couple of people who are here as part of our group were with me in a precept affinity group that we did last year, where we met monthly for about 8 months to really compare our notes and our insights about precept practice. So thank you for bringing your voices to the conversation. So I called this talk, partly because it has to have a name for the CIMI news, but I call this talk The Power of Negative Thinking. And it's not a talk about negative or troublesome thoughts. And I called it that because I really wanted to focus on the precepts as a practice of refraining or renunciation, really as a practice of not doing. But just as context for that conversation, I really want to highlight how deeply our tradition cherishes precept practice as something that points toward real happiness and harmony. So I'm going to read just a little excerpt from one of the suttas, suttas or Buddhist discourses, that talks about this. And this is from the Anguttara Nikaya. And in the sutta or the story, this is the Buddha speaking. So the Buddha says, now there are these five gifts, five great gifts, original, long-standing, traditional, ancient, unadulterated, meaning pure, unadulterated from the beginning, that are not open to suspicion, will never be open to suspicion, and are unfaulted by knowledgeable contemplatives and Brahmins. Which five? There is the case where a disciple of the noble ones, abandoning the taking of life, abstains from taking life. In doing so, he gives freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, freedom from oppression to limitless numbers of beings. In giving freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, freedom from oppression to limitless numbers of beings, he gains a share in limitless freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, and freedom from oppression. And then the Buddha says the same thing about the other four precepts. And then the Buddha goes on to say that doing this offers, and here are the words of the sutta again, nourishment of happiness, celestial, resulting in happiness, leading to heaven, leading to what is desirable, pleasurable, and appealing, to welfare and happiness. So, according to this sutta, not killing, not taking what is not given, etc., leads to celestial happiness. And, you know, you might have noticed that happiness was mentioned three times in one sentence as the fruit of just not doing these five things. And in brief, ethical conduct is appreciated in this tradition as a path that actually brings us into harmony with ourselves and harmony with others. And so the thought is that we start with outer actions as guided by specific rules of conduct, which are the precepts, but that over time we really internalize the wholesome qualities and that this is a real source of peace and ease. So my intention for tonight's talk is to offer and also to invite from you some perspectives on how this practice of not doing really makes room for a very rich and beautiful exploration, and an exploration that supports us on this path of practice. And just as shorthand, when I say path of practice, I am talking about the Eightfold Path, which in brief, you know, we understand to be the path away from self-inflicted unsatisfactoriness or dukkha, which is also sometimes called suffering. So I'll talk a little bit about the traditional understanding of each precept, the classical understanding of each precept, and the value of precept practice as a practice of abstaining or renunciation, and some ways we might practice with the precepts, and I suspect that many of you will also have ideas about ways to practice with the precepts. But before we do that, just a little bit of context, just a little bit of general context about practicing with the precepts. So first, as I've already said a few times now, they're framed in the negative, and we'll hear more about that. Then just a note about what does it mean when we say we take the precepts. And in essence, these are vows that are taken for the sake of training. So there's one word, you can look at the handout, but you don't need to, but the handout has the precepts on the first page written in the Pali language, which is the ancient Indian language that many of the original teachings were first rendered in, and the English as well. And there's one Pali word, sikapada, that is repeated in each of the precepts. And that word literally means factor of training. So taking the precepts means taking a training vow. And going further, what I mean personally when I talk about a training vow is that it's taking steps to hold the precepts in our awareness really as continuously as we can, basically so that they become established as a reference point or as a touchstone. Also want to mention that precept practice dovetails with the Eightfold Path. So sila, which means ethical conduct, is the first of three trainings that actually form the Eightfold Path. And it's understood to be the first training because we seem to need some base of ethical conduct. It seems to be a prerequisite for being able to train the mind in meditation. We can't even have the minimal stillness or peace of mind to begin training if we're not conducting our lives with some measure of ethics. Now, I'm going to get editorial here. How many people have heard one or more, and I'm guessing more, teachers say that the precepts are not commandments? You ever heard that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think what I want to offer is that from what I understand of working with the precepts, that that's accurate up to a point. But if we don't understand what's meant, it really can be a little bit misleading or confusing. And I have a few reasons for saying that. One is that really within the Buddhist tradition, as it's been understood for 2,500 years, not just as it's understood in the West in the 21st century, the precepts are seen as a minimum ethical code that's binding on lay practitioners. And really, as a practical matter, it's just really hard for me to see how the precepts are optional if we're going to take them on meaningfully. Now, it is true that we're choosing to take them on for the purpose of waking up. But the practice that we're taking on voluntarily is not morally relativistic. The precepts actually offer, as you'll see in just a minute, the precepts actually offer a very clear set of reference points. So here's what Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's a contemporary Western monk and scholar, says about this very question. He says, the precepts are not commandments imposed from without, but principles of training each one takes upon himself through his own initiative, and sorry about the non-gender inclusive language, and endeavors to follow with awareness and understanding. So they're voluntary in the sense that they're not imposed from without, but if we're taking them on for the sake of practice, what we're taking on is following them. So for me, really understanding that, the sense of personal choice and the sense that it's a rule-based practice are really two sides of the same coin. However, just to mess with your mind, I also think that it's obvious that if we take precept practice seriously, there is absolutely no way that we can always and unfailingly, quote unquote, follow the precepts in lockstep. It is not a recipe book. And this is not just because we're human, and even if we do our best, we will sometimes fall down on the job. I'm not even talking about that. I'm really talking about the fact that life is complex. And the ultimate commitment, and really what we're exploring in precept practice, is non-harming and our relationship with non-harming. So an unwavering commitment to non-harming might mean not, quote unquote, following a precept. And really, if we're going to take this seriously at all, as a practice and as an ongoing practice, practicing with the precepts means wrestling with this, you know, with as much discernment as we can muster. And this has to include paying really close attention to our intentions. So the obvious example, which many of us have heard, I think, in more than one Dharma talk in this room, lying to the Nazis if you're sheltering Anne Frank, you know, that's not a dilemma, that's a no-brainer. But in our lives, we encounter much more subtle dilemmas, and there are dilemmas, just to acknowledge that. But if we're working with this, and if we're seeing the precepts as binding and as something we're taking on for the sake of training, but also as, you know, very clear reference points, but and yet as things that we can't follow as a cookbook, we really, how can we do that? We really need to monitor our intentions with tremendous honesty. So to give a really, you know, perhaps trivial example, but I think the trivial examples are sometimes the ones we really learn from, I'm just thinking about, you know, what is our, people talk a lot about little benign lies, you know, little benign lies that we tell because we don't want to hurt the other person's feelings. And this is the kind of moral situation, ethical situation, where we might, situation by situation, want to look into our own hearts and actually see if we can understand what our motivation is. You know, is it kindness in any given situation? There isn't a blanket rule here. It's something that only we can answer for ourselves. But is our motivation kindness, or is our motivation sparing ourselves awkwardness? Is it actually a form of aversion? So kind of, I'm going to talk now about what the classical understanding is of each precept, but I've said a lot already. So any questions, confusions, if I lost you on anything here? Okay, great. So I'd like to then talk about what each precept is and how it's been understood in the tradition. The first one, refraining from taking life. We're talking about not killing. The Pali word panatipata literally means not striking down, and it's understood to include not injuring. And you can just feel in that translation striking out that there is an intention to harm. It doesn't just apply traditionally to our relationship with humans. It's understood to apply to any living being that has breath and consciousness. And traditionally, they're understood to be five factors that go into whether the precept has been crossed or breached. That there is a living being. Your perception or understanding that there's a living being, the volition to kill, that's an intention. Action that's directed toward taking that life. And that can be direct or indirect. You're culpable whether you take the life or direct someone else to do that. And that the living being actually dies. So just listening to this, like, what might this not be?
If you have an animal that is suffering that you have put down?
That's an interesting question.
I think that's
a very nuanced example, because I guess one of the questions, it's not one that I've had to confront, but very many friends have, there might be a question whether you're really taking the life at that point. Or that might be a situation where you are, but where it falls into this can't follow it lockstep because of the orientation toward, you know, overall non-harming. And I'm actually thinking of something even, you know, much more trivial than your important example. It's not. Yeah.
What about unavoidable taking of life? Like, for example, driving fast in the car, and then there's your windshield, and your car splattered with dead bugs.
You know, the dead bugs was exactly what I was going to say.
I suppose you could say you don't have to drive, but I mean, realistically speaking, there's all kinds of little creatures that you can't even see. So I mean, you know.
You can't plow a field, apparently, without some of the time, you know, to produce vegetarian food without some animals getting hurt in the process. So, yeah, I mean, because the bugs on your windshield are not beings that you had an intention to kill, but that striking out piece. And another example in the tradition that is not part of the strict precept, part of the strict precept practice, is actually eating meat if you have not killed the animal or caused it to be killed. Now, it absolutely, as taking a larger view of this practice, it absolutely can be valuable to take on a more refined exploration that goes beyond the bare precept. I'm not at all discouraging that, but I'm just starting here with a clear understanding of what the basic traditional precept is for purposes of discussing precept practice. So the second precept, refraining from what's not given. Again, there are a number of factors. Something has to actually belong to another person legally and blamelessly. In taking it, you perceive that it belongs to another person. You actually have the thought or intention of stealing it, taking it, and you engage in the act of taking it and actually take it. And so this is not, since it's talking about taking something from someone that has that thing legally and blamelessly, this is not about taking a gun from a child or from someone who's about to do harm with it. You know, it's fairly basic. And also want to say about this one that in contemporary practice, we often hear the precept phrased, not taken what's not freely given. And as far as I've been able to glean, the freely piece seems to be a little bit of a contemporary flourish. And for me, trying to actually practice with these precepts, it seems a little bit vague.
I've seen this actually in practice. In Yunnan province in China, they don't have any fences. And so I wondered, what in the world is this? You know, here are these people that have cattle and so forth. They don't have fences. It's just not what we do here. And so I finally was asking around, and these are Tibetan Buddhists. And if they steal something, they're not sure what they're going to come back as. And so this is their motive, you know, this is the end result, but nevertheless, it's really lived, and it just all over the province where you see this kind of thing, even stores and whatever, you know.
And that's a great example. That's a great example because they have this sense of what's owned by another and respecting it.
Exactly.
And in terms of understanding the consequences, whether a person in this room embraced, you know, a rebirth cosmology or not, I think there's such a clear psychological understanding that we do inherit the fruits of our actions here. You know, this is even, as I said before, part of why the sila precept practice may be the first training in the Eightfold Path, because that basic peace of mind that we take away from ourselves if we're creating an absence of safety for others. So yeah, thank you for that example. The third precept is refraining from sexual misconduct. The Pali literally means going about the senses or sensual pleasure wrongly. In the tradition, it's usually understood to mean sexual misconduct, but certainly there's a rich exploration in whether there are ethical issues in how we go about satisfying other sense pleasures. And you may know, especially if you've either spent time with monastics or been on retreat, that the monastic version of this precept is abstinence. When we go on retreat, normally the version of the precept we take is abstinence. But for lay people, it is more about not doing harm. The classical understanding relates to very specific forbidden categories of sexual partners, some of which are specific to ancient India, as well as violent, forced, or coerced sex. And obviously, for this to be a meaningful exploration, we do need to apply the specifics in the context of our own culture. But the core practice, which is refraining from doing harm through sexual conduct, really hasn't changed in 2,500 years. The application certainly may have. And this is an area of tremendous human vulnerability and an area where our actions have enormous consequences. And it's really understood that engaging with this precept inherently brings in attention to the other precepts, such as refraining from false speech. So the fourth precept is refraining from false speech. And again, traditional factors, something is untrue, there's an intention to deceive another. So this isn't about saying something that you genuinely and sincerely believe is true, and then later on you find out it isn't. There are problems with that, but that's not what this precept is. You make an effort to express the thing that you know to be untrue, and you actually convey a false impression to another person. And expanding beyond lying or false speech, in the suttas, unwise speech actually is understood to include four aspects. So just one line from the Samyutta Nikaya. And what is right speech? Abstaining from lying, from divisive speech, from abusive speech, and from idle chatter. This is called right speech. And these four aspects of wise speech really are fertile ground for exploring our intentions. I know that one that has that I've spent time on and that my attention has been drawn to since we're taking up precept practice has been divisive speech. And this kind of surprised me a little bit because I've really made an effort for many years, you know, not to gossip, not to trash people behind their backs in obvious ways. I mean, I probably don't do it perfectly, but I mean, I actually had felt that I, you know, maintain a fairly high standard about that. But I've noticed increasingly that if I'm talking about another person, to another person, and just know that there is not a broad precept that says you cannot engage in third-party speech. But I'll often notice if I'm talking about a third person, maybe discussing with a helpful or supportive friend something I'm struggling with about how I'm handling something with another person, I'll notice just this little question arising about whether there is kind of a subtle motivation creeping in to, at some level, separate the person I'm talking to from the other person. Not, full bore, trashing, but just that as I'm doing this thing that seems to be ethical and moral, how am I really talking about the person? What's in my heart? You know, is there some kind of desire to cement an us that doesn't include that person? And again, because there isn't a broad precept, don't engage in third-party speech, it's all about as we interact with other people in the world, as we live our lives, just paying a lot of attention to our motivations. So finally, the last precept, refraining from intoxicants. Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of the precept is, I undertake the training rule to abstain from fermented and distilled intoxicants, which are the basis for heedlessness. And in Pali, there is ambiguity about how the different words in the sentence modify one another. And don't worry, we're not going to parse the Pali. I do not have that set of skills. But just to say that the ambiguity technically, or that the ambiguity technically leaves open whether the precept includes all intoxicants or just fermented and distilled intoxicants, which would basically be alcohol. But traditionally, it's understood to include intoxicating drugs, since the focus is on intoxication and heedlessness. And also just to acknowledge that contemporary Western teachers, senior, very serious teachers, really differ among themselves about whether the precept refers to all consumption of intoxicants, or whether the meaning is about avoiding intoxication and heedlessness, meaning that for some people, one drink might not be a problem. I think that there's a lot of room to explore this and to, you know, look at our own intentions in consuming or not consuming intoxicants, and how consuming any amount of intoxicant might actually affect our awareness. Because you're not going to get, one interpretation that all teachers you respect are going to agree on. Treat it as an area where you can explore, again, with the starting point of the exploration being what is my real intention. So,
as you've been talking about this, I've been trying to see how it correlates with, in my own mind, with Christian, the Ten Commandments. And this is one that I don't think people, they may do it, but it's not something that, at least as far as I know, you're specifically not supposed to do, at least in the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And actually,
I'm sorry, it's not just Christian, it's
right.
I understood that.
But I think it's interesting because, of course, even in Buddhist practice, there are all kinds of different intersecting and overlapping lists, and you won't find the refraining from intoxicants in the version of right action that is described in the Eightfold Path. And people talk about that because, unlike the other four precepts, it's not something using intoxicants or even becoming intoxicated is not inherently something that immediately affects another person. Mm-hmm. You can say that that the more you understand about it, the more you can say that maybe it does, but I mean just overtly. And yet, among other things, it's seen as something that can cause us to be more heedless, which affects our behavior with respect to the other precepts. And sometimes as people get more and more refined in their meditation practice, in their awareness practice, they find that the impact, they're aware of more and more subtle impacts. So that without considering it overtly unethical, you know, I've had teachers who have said, gee, I actually really enjoyed wine, I didn't have a problem with it, but I found as I practiced more and more deeply that even having one glass affected my ability to bring full awareness, for example, to my meditation, to my training. And those are the kinds of things that people can explore for themselves. And also just to respect that there are teachers, contemporary teachers, for example, Noah Levine, who also have deep roots in the 12-step movement, you know, who really try to point out that there are many people for whom, you know, this is, you know, any consumption is a problem, and who have really tried to foster some sensitivity to that in Buddhist communities in supporting, you know, our fellow practitioners. So I'm going to speed ahead a little bit in order to make sure that we have, yeah.
And I've also heard that expanded to many different kinds of intoxication, like food, like zoning out the technology, and that can be a kind of heedlessness to the people around you, etc.
When I personally, and thank you for raising that, when I personally take the precepts in the morning, I do kind of an expanded version, and I talk about habits and distractions, and I'm very aware of the way I can numb out, you know, with my iPhone. So yeah, and all kinds of different forms of consumption, distraction, giving into habit. I think what's important, just because we can do so much with this that it can sometimes seem, you know, how could we ever wrap our arms around the precepts? How could we ever say that we're, you know, living up to them? I think it's also important, and this is part of why I also wanted to articulate just the bare precepts, because this expansion and deeper exploration of all the ramifications is very important, but to know that at that point we are doing, you know, a more expanded practice. So in order to make sure that we have room for some group discussion, I'm going to just talk a little bit about some of the reasons that I think the precepts are framed in the negative and a few ways we might practice with the precepts, and then I'll make sure that we have a chunk of time for questions and people to reflect on their own practice. So, you know, there really could be a lot of different reasons that the precepts are framed in the negative, meaning the not doing this, not doing this, refraining from this. And I will throw out a few, but then I will tell you what my favorite is, where the real meat is for me. So the list of precepts is framed in the negative, but each precept is really understood to include an affirmative quality that is to be cultivated. So to provide just one example, and this is again from one of the suttas, the disciple abstaining from the taking of life dwells without stick or sword, conscientious, full of sympathy, desirous of the welfare of all living beings. So in reality, these are considered to be intertwined. It's also important to realize that precept practice is not the whole of the teachings, and it's not the whole of Buddhist practice. You know, we have the Brahma-viharas, the four divine abodes, metta, which is boundless loving-kindness, and the other heart qualities, the five spiritual faculties, the seven factors of awakening, which include our core affirmative practice of mindfulness. So the abstaining, the not doing piece, abstaining from unwholesome physical and mental conduct, it's one doorway into practice. But it's an important doorway, because wise intention, which is the second fold of the Eightfold Path, actually includes renunciation. So not to be sneezed at. It's also understood that we sometimes need to begin by abstaining from unwholesome actions before we can cultivate affirmative qualities such as loving kindness. And, you know, I'm going to say that for me, sometimes the affirmative qualities or the positive qualities, you know, boundless love for all living beings, as important as those ultimately are, can feel kind of vague and aspirational. And we really cannot have a rule mandating specific feelings, such as love for all beings. We can cultivate it, but we really can't mandate it. Whereas the precepts are very specific, and we can follow them, even if we have these nuances, you know, situations where we determine that we shouldn't, and we can engage with them very concretely. The other thing is that the actions that are prohibited by the precepts are all motivated by unwholesome mental factors. And we're talking here about the defilements, which are also called the kilesas, greed, aversion, and delusion, and all of their different variations and manifestations. And these actions really reinforce the grip of the defilements on the mind. And conversely, and just think about, you know, in your own life, think about whether that's true. When you have a sense that something isn't going to bring about such great results, that it's not coming from a very sound place in you, and you do it anyway, do you have the sense that that does reinforce the grip of those more negative or less wholesome emotions? Yeah, I certainly have that sense. But
I was listening. you know, as you were talking about this, one of the things that would turn around in my mind is how to conceptualize it. And what I came up with, and maybe other people disagree, is a polygon where there's, you know, the eightfold path, there's this and so forth, but they're all part of this whole thing.
Yes. Yes. That's beautifully put, and it's so true of our practice. And I love, for example, that the eightfold path is eight folds. It's not like some lockstep thing. You do this, and then you do this, and then you do this.
Yeah,
it's everything interrelates. Anywhere you start, even though we talk about a first training and a second training, you know, in reality, wherever you start, you're bringing in all of the different qualities. So yeah, thank you for articulating that. And, you know, just putting on the brakes sometimes, not acting on that unwholesome impulse. I think we've also, I'm sure, all had lots of experiences of that as well, can really help condition the growth of wholesome mind states such as love and compassion. And, you know, as you heard in the very first sutta that I read from, refraining from unwholesome actions really confers a huge benefit because of the safety that we offer ourselves and others. Finally, and this is, you know, there are lots of different reasons, and I'm cutting some of them short, but this is really, for me, the real meat as a practitioner of why there is value in this refraining or not doing or renunciation practice. And that is, and this is very practical, it's really a practice issue, that the act of refraining from these unwholesome actions plus paying attention has enormous practical value for cultivating insight. It's just a very, very rich field of practice. So what happens is when we commit to these training vows and then we pay attention to what emerges, we inevitably see both our own wholesome intentions and our own unwholesome intentions. You know, we see the generosity and kindness, we see the defilements that stand in the way, and we get to see these in very specific situations that we're in our lives. My experience, my personal experience, is that after saying the precepts to myself day after day for, you know, now a number of years, they've started to operate, and I will just say at times, but they've started to operate at times almost as if they're waiting in the background. And then, you know, something comes up in my life, an impulse to say or do something unskillful, and sometimes a tiny bit of wisdom or recognition might just bubble up. It might bubble up before I do anything. But, you know, we've all talked about and heard about practicing before, during, and after. Sometimes it bubbles up while. Sometimes it bubbles up after the fact. But we're still conditioning this relationship with the precepts and with looking at our intentions.
And I think that part of that is that the refraining isn't having to change an action into another action. It's as that stuff will bubble up, just pausing.
Yes.
Just stop for a second.
Yes.
It for me, it brings me back into the body. It brings me back into the present moment.
Yes.
And it doesn't even take very long. And if I had to replace that impulse with like another going out impulse, I don't think I would quite, it's not as easy to do that somehow as just to go to pull back just for a second, because the refrain has real the refraining has real energy to it.
Yes. So that's so beautifully put. And to build on that, as you're saying, you can't conversely say, well, I'm just going to replace it with loving all beings.
Right.
But the stopping, and just to be really concrete, very congruently with what, you know, with what you said so beautifully, is that when we do this kind of investigation, it's not about figuring it out or analyzing it. We're actually stopping and holding an open question and then allowing whatever understanding or recognition emerges or sometimes doesn't. So we're talking, as you said, about experiential understanding. You know, what are we experiencing in the body? What's the flavor in the mind? It could be as basic as a felt sense of pleasant or unpleasant, or maybe feeling our jaw tighten. And, you know, and then I put this to myself in all caps, that when we don't act out our impulses toward unwholesome action, we really get to sit with the reactions that emerge in the mind and body. And this is the field of practice. This is what practice is all about. So I'd like to give just one or two examples of how this has unfolded in my practice, and then just talk a tiny bit about some ways of practicing, and then, you know, kind of throw it open. Also appreciate that people have been bringing their insights into the discussion throughout. So the examples I'm going to offer are kind of small, down-to-earth examples, very humble, kind of seemingly small, maybe even trivial. But I think we sometimes overlook how much we learn from these little moments. And also for many of us, and I certainly experience practice this way, insights often arrive in really small packages. But then the small packages are cumulative. They're not throwaways. So false speech. I was chatting last week with someone that I hadn't met before in just a social situation, and it was a bit of one of these getting to know you conversations. And I found myself midway into the conversation offering up what I can only call a cocktail party version of my life, if you have a feeling for what that means. It wasn't a cocktail party, but nonetheless. And nothing I said, and I've really reflected on this more than once now, especially because I know I was going to be giving this talk, and really nothing I said was factually untrue, and I don't think even that I exaggerated. I'm not certain of that, but I don't think I did. But I really found myself cringing, you know, in the body. And, you know, what happened is as I talked, I just saw myself painting this kind of bright, shiny, spiffy version of my life that didn't ring true. And, you know, I was talking about activities that I engage in my real life with pretty wholesome intentions, you know, honestly, including this Buddhist practice. But I was subtly turning it into a thing, you know, an identity, and clearly an identity that I hope would engender some positive regard. And I saw this pretty quickly in the middle of doing it. And at first, the seeing mostly took the sense of this uncomfortable sense of squirming. You know, so this is felt experientially in the body, in the emotions. And then in the last several days, I have reflected, and maybe reflected more because I knew that, you know, we were going to be talking about things and I wanted to provide a real life example. I've reflected on what the underlying motivations might have been. And by motivation here, we mean greed, aversion, delusion, or their opposites, generosity, kindness, wisdom. And so, you know, I've asked myself, was I grasping at some perceived pleasant experience, like being liked, you know, greed, pushing away some unpleasant experience? And so far, and I'm just letting this unfold, but so far my sense is that the mind was pushing away kind of an unpleasant sense of awkwardness that included not knowing what to say about my life now that I'm not in a quote-unquote day job because I'm quote-unquote retired. And so I don't have a neat one-liner about what I do. And I also had a recognition as the reflection unfolded some more that this discomfort, the sort of who am I, am, you know, I, in five words or less, that it seems to be intertwined with some kind of grasping for a solid identity. And there's a piece of delusion in the Buddhist sense. Delusion about the nature of reality, about how things really work, including kind of a solid enduring I. So it's pretty subtle, and as I said, I wasn't lying. I maybe wasn't even stretching the truth. And so you could ask why it even matters. But for me, it really matters a lot. And for one thing, paying attention in this way has really contributed to some insight about my motivations. And I think that insight about our motivations really is the heart of the practice, right? I mean, this is how we start to see how our habits of mind contribute to an experience of unsatisfactoriness or dukkha, or how our habits of mind can lead to peace and ease. So another example, and this is about the first precept, not taking life. So, you know, as a result of precept practice, it has become more reflexive for me to try to get insects that I like out of my space without killing them. And this really was not on my radar. I really didn't care about it before I started cultivating the precepts. And when I first started paying attention to this, so what I would do is there'd be a spider. I live four houses from the levee, Sacramento River. There are a lot of spiders. And I would gather up a spider in a tissue and take it outside. But I had to acknowledge to myself pretty quickly that mostly I was mangling the critters. And, but I actually didn't want to, because, you know, you can't really, their spiders are pretty delicate. You can't always just put them in a tissue and think that's going to work. And I realized, no, I don't really want to do this. So now I've actually learned to put a drinking glass over the spider and slide a stiff piece of paper between the spider and the floor and carry it outside and set it free. So I've actually seen, though, that I have, that by the refraining, I actually have this desire to not be harmful. So last week, a neighbor left some really nice Asian pears from his yard on my doorstep. And when I took them into my kitchen, I suddenly realized that the ants were crawling all over one of the pears and onto my hand, and I had this immediate yuck reaction. So yuck, unpleasant, aversion. Without even thinking about it, I quickly put the pear and my hand under the faucet to wash off the ants, and obviously killing them. I hadn't even thought about it. But as soon as I saw what was happening, I felt this immediate pinch of regret. And, you know, look, to be honest, because we're talking about small moments, this was not a cataclysmic event for me. I'm not beating up on myself about it. But, you know, the sense of remorse lasted for a few moments. But I actually saw that repeating the first precept to myself day after day has actually started cultivating this genuine preference not to harm, you know, even a tiny being like this. And again, it's kind of a subtle and homely example, but it illustrates the kind of cumulative small changes that we can experience as we do this practice. So if I were to sum up everything I've said up until this point in one sentence, I would say that taking on this training, refraining from doing these five unwholesome actions, and paying attention to what emerges is a form of experiential investigation that cultivates awareness, wisdom, and kindness to ourselves and others. So before we do a little more question-answer kind of group contributions, just a few brief thoughts on how we might practice with the precepts. And please, you know, when we throw it open, share other ways that you've maybe found useful. So to state the obvious, there's enormous value in just not doing these five things. You know, many of us in this room are living very ethical lives. You know, I'm sure none of us perfectly, but I think that people here are paying a lot of attention to this and putting some real effort into leading ethical lives. So, you know, we sometimes gloss over this, but please appreciate how beneficial what you're already doing is for yourself and for many, many other beings. And then, you know, take it in. Let this appreciation infuse your practice. It can actually be a real source of faith and confidence in practice. So beyond this, just a couple of thoughts about how we might make sila a formal practice. One is just try reciting the precepts every day, out loud or silently. One isn't better than the other, whichever you prefer. And then observe what unfolds. Just literally just notice over time what you notice. Some people find it enormously valuable to chant the precepts in Pali or in English, and I would just mention that the Abhayagiri Monastery website, and I put that on the handout, has both a PDF chanting book and also some audio downloadable chants. In my own practice, I take the precepts silently. I find it very valuable, and our friend in the front row actually had suggested this practice to me about a year ago. I find it very valuable to say the precepts to myself somewhat slowly, leaving a little time in between for reflections to float up. And sometimes, you know, when they do, when I leave this time between precepts and kind of say them to myself slowly, I might suddenly recognize a challenge that's looming in the day ahead and might take a moment to reflect on how I might handle the situation. You know, sometimes I just notice attitudes or motivations, experiences in the body, emotions, and so forth. And sometimes nothing concrete comes up. And this is really important in any kind of reflective practice, that we're opening up to reflections and insights and experiences that might bubble up. It might be nothing that bubbles up, or something that's so subtle we don't recognize it until later. These practices could be coupled with brief reflection at the end of the day, a nightly review, as simple as, you know, how did it go? That can be very reinforcing. And for some people, it can also be useful to jot down a few notes. So, you know, I want to stop at this point. We have about 10 minutes left in the talk. I appreciate that people participate throughout, but let's spend the rest of the time. Any questions or just any reflections you might have on your own experience working with the precepts? Any thought about this focus on refraining and abstaining or anything else you want to talk about?
I was thinking of something that happened today. And retrospectively looking at something, and I'm sort of chewing up this thing in my mind, I was talking to someone, and I really made a stupid comment. Why did you do that? You know, it doesn't make sense. And I really wanted to apologize to this person, but that was not possible at that time. But still, it's just, why did you do that for? But, you know, examining the thing and not just letting it go by, but really examining what I did. And so, I didn't feel guilty particularly, but, you know, it was stupid. You know, that's the best I can say.
But I appreciate how, I mean, I thank you very much for sharing that and for the honesty. And I appreciate kind of the nuance in what you're saying, because you're acknowledging that there was this discomfort.
Right.
You're not, the acknowledgement, and the tradition sometimes distinguishes between remorse and guilt.
Yeah.
They're just words, but you're describing what the tradition sometimes calls remorse, meaning you genuinely regretted doing something that you felt had the wrong consequence, and you genuinely looked at what your options were. There is no additional value in beating up on yourself, but you weren't. But yet you were looking at it with this clear lens. Yeah. So thank you. Anyone else?
What struck me when you said in the traditional understanding of the first precept, eating meat or animal doesn't seem to be in conflict. That's what I heard you said. That's how I understood. Maybe that's not what you're saying, but if you can you elaborate?
I would love to elaborate. So first of all, because this talk was very deliberately about, you know, one piece of practice, which is the abstaining from these five unskillful actions, I felt it was important to give the bare, you know, sense of what the tradition says about the precepts. Mm-hmm. But the tradition does a lot more than that. And the tradition really has all kinds of opportunities for cultivating affirmative qualities, loving kindness. I mean, there are many, many practices. And even looking at just the precepts, especially in our complex Western society, many people take very seriously. For example, when I said, well, part of the precept as it's classically understood is that you actually act to take the life or cause someone else to do it. Well, people have done some, you know, some serious thinking about what it means in a complex modern economy to be part of the chain of demand for animals that have been killed. That's something that, while I have not chosen mostly to be a vegetarian, it's something that I continue to wrestle with and take very seriously. It's also true that not all Buddhist cultures are vegetarian. Traditionally, in the ancient suttas, there's actually a dispute between the Buddha and one of his cousins who was trying to establish sort of a rival camp that in some respects was stricter and wanted the Buddha to mandate that everyone be vegetarian. We don't know that this is history. I'm describing the story as told by the sutta, but it still embodies, you know, some values of the tradition. And the Buddha did not want to mandate that the monastics who were dependent on lay people and their generosity only eat non-animal. And then, in fact, that might be an unfair demand on the lay people. Now, that's a monastic perspective. That may not apply to us. We have a lot more control. And monastics in our society have a lot more control over what they eat. But, for example, in the Tibetan tradition, it's less typical to find vegetarians. I think the Dalai Lama has been vegetarian at times, but he's kind of a world thinker who doesn't embody just one tradition. So I was by no means, I mean, the important thing is yes, we can feel real discomfort. When I went on my first metta retreat, loving kindness retreat, I had this very powerful experience that this experience of boundless love for all beings, which we were at least cultivating, for me did conflict with being a predator. Again, I at times have been vegetarian, at times I haven't. So just to say I take this inquiry very seriously, and through all of the different avenues of practice, the affirmative cultivations, the loving kindness, the looking in a sophisticated way at our modern economy and at whether even buying meat is a form of demand, these are all very important inquiries. So I just wanted to articulate that the precept, kind of the four corners of the precept, didn't per se demand that we be vegetarians, that it's more of an exploration. Does that make sense? Okay. Linnell.
So what I think is that you don't practice these very long before you realize that they're impossible to do 100%. And for me, there's two pieces of that. One is that I do continue to reflect, but I also feel like part of practice is to be able to hold the fact that you make a decision, even if the decision is to do something that doesn't feel like it's 100% the precept, eating meat if it's healthy, some of the speech things. The not killing is actually, I mean, sometimes you do kill an ant, but I don't say, oh, it's okay to kill the ant. I don't say that to myself, but I do realize that I can't really have them all in the house crawling all over everything and eating up everything and whatever all that is. And I talk to them and tell them to leave, and sometimes it seems to sort of work. But the reality is that all these ambiguities, and none of it's clear cut, and I think that's where the practice comes in, because part of the human condition is that we can't, it just seems impossible, unless we're enlightened, we can't quite do it. You know?
And if we
were, both things are true.
And if we were, the way everything affects everything else in the world, we still might not be able to.
It would still make it difficult.
So we're coming to the end. I saw a couple of hands, and I think I'm going to just call on a couple more people, and then I'm happy to stay a little bit afterwards if my ride is going for me to do that, but I want to make sure that we close pretty close to 9.
Well, I just think the word refrain is, I like it. To say everything, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do the other. The list would be voluminous and never end. But to refrain from things, it allows you to reflect on where you are as a person and what is behind your intention, and then to work with that. The other comment I have is about the incorrect speech. And for myself, that includes incorrect thoughts relating to people and the judgmental there. And particularly if I'm shifting, a task off to somebody else, and I want to explain a relationship with someone, I'm very conscious of not saying, this other person is a jerk. You just have to do it yourself. You know, so it's that thing.
Yeah, and thank you for both of those perspectives. And yeah, because our thoughts are part of our intentions.
Yeah.
I think this is the last comment for our group as a whole.
I try to look with the first precept of not both not destroying and also not doing harm. And just from my personal perspective, I have been completely vegan since 1991. I don't see any other on a personal level any other ethical choice. But what it also relates to for me, and again, it's about the broader society and some of what happens, is that it's both the harm to the animals that are killed or who are essentially tortured, as in the milk industry and so forth, but it's also about the people who have to do that. And I do meditations in which I ask for blessings for both, and one of the things, and it happened to me before I was vegan, and it took me a period of time to process it, but when I was young and was working for the welfare department in LA, and there was a man who was told in order for his family to continue to get welfare, he had to take, and they would have starved without it, he had to take whatever job was available. And the job that was available was in a slaughterhouse, And where he was, he said, I will take my life before I will do that, or I will have to leave my family. And his horrendous pain, and he knew other people who had worked in that kind of thing. And you know, for me, that's another part of the realization that what happens also to the karma of those people. And what does that do to them? And it becomes a whole, I mean, everything's interconnected to everything, and that's another way that that things are just interconnected and do other kinds of damage that I don't think that human beings should have to go through either.
So that is, you know, and as a note to end on, because we could go forever, thank you for really that so honest and so poignant and nuanced description of, you know, how you have explored the different consequences and your relationship to them. And in addition to the specifics, you know, that you're talking about, you know, that have led you to your ethical decisions, that it illustrates something else that I think we do encounter when we do this precept practice, that we may start on kind of a crude level, and it's valuable to start on a crude level, just the four corners of the bare precept. But in any aspect of practice, including precept practice, we start in one place with the obvious. And it really does start refining our hearts and minds. It does start creeping into our consciousness, and we become aware at a more and more subtle level. And so you're really describing how, you know, really living with these issues, things that wouldn't be obvious at first blush start really emerging. And how you wrestle with that might not be identical to how someone, you know, in another seat here does, but that sense of taking it in at a heartfelt level and paying, we pay closer and closer attention, and it's almost as we as we are able to let go of one level of delusion or grasping or aversion, and as we refine our content, you know, our conduct, more and more comes into our awareness. That can be very uncomfortable, but ultimately I think it's also a source of freedom. So thank you for helping us end on that note. And we'll just end with just a brief metta and dedication of merit, and then if people have questions afterwards, I can hang out for a bit. So just taking a moment and letting all of the words that we've shared and the thoughts and the feelings kind of recede a little bit into the background, returning to a felt sense of the body in the chair or on the mat. And may any merit, any fruit that has arisen from our practice together tonight, from our exploration of wholesome ideas, our sharing of insights, our aspiration to hold our lives as ethically as we can, really allow us to act for the benefit of ourselves and of all living beings. May all beings be safe and protected from all forms of inner and outer harm. May all beings be happy and peaceful. May all beings be as healthy and strong as they can in these mortal bodies. And may all beings be able to care for themselves with ease. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Thank you very much for your practice.